Peter R. Breggin, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT, and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour.
Hello, 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 my wonderful audience. Once again, it is my honor to get a chance to speak to all of you. It's a bright, sunny day here right now outside my large chunk of glass that is covering my home office wall. I have 6 goldfinches. 6 goldfinches flitting about. They come and they go. On several feeders yesterday, I had about 20 goldfinches. It's goldfinch day, as well as lots of other birds. Red-winged blackbirds are among my favorites because I've never had them before this year come to the feeders. So I'm glad to be here again. And don't forget that we are going to take questions and answers with our guest, along with our guest today. But I especially want the ones that are going to address this marvelous, marvelous woman that I'm going to have on the show, psychiatrist, man or woman's, wonderful psychiatrist. And I'll tell you her name, and I'll check in and see if she's there, and then I'll finish up with a few more comments. Gail, are you there?
Yeah.
Oh, gosh, you sound clear. My guest today, as I announced on my frequent alerts, which I hope all of you get, is Gail Tash, and it's a T, and then like in cash, Tash. Gail Tash,
that's
she's
right.
From Wisconsin. She's a psychiatrist, and she's going to be talking about what she went through and has gone through and is doing about the disillusionment she experienced with her profession and how that came about. And we're going to have a really, really interesting conversation. It's not often I get to introduce a new psychiatrist on the show. Remember, this is the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour. You call in at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888. Breaking news on my website, this amazing new feature that my assistant Ian is doing a great job with. One of the more interesting things today is I've lost my note on this most interesting thing today as I shifted. 13 reasons, I'll have to do it from memory. It was this television show which talks a lot about and seems to encourage suicide. And two studies have come out. One saying, yes, there's an increase in the rate of suicide in the boys in particular who are watching this show. And then another study has come out, and you'll see that up there too, in which it says, oh no, if they watch the whole show, it's good. Then they may even do better, be better off. But what they fail to emphasize and what the news coverage is not even mentioning is that these two studies have almost nothing to do with each other, because the first one is of children under 18. It's boys, 10 to 17 were found to have a higher suicide rate when they watch this show. And then it's the 18 to 29-year-olds in the second study who didn't seem to be badly affected by it. Well, there's a huge difference between watching TV from 18 to 29 and watching it from 10 to 17. And anybody with any sense would predict greater problems in the younger group. See it all on daily breaking news. There's lots of stuff about positive approaches to your own mental health and lots of stuff about just what you're interested in terms of criticism of psychiatry. And the show, for all of you who are just sort of tuning in from some odd place, it's 4 p.m. every Wednesday. And this is 4 p.m. on May 1st, 2019. And that's New York time. New York time. And I really appreciate the many listeners who have been sending in messages and enjoying the show. It means a lot to me. And it keeps me in touch with what shows you especially like. And I'm glad we got a really good response to some of the radical stuff about the destruction of boyhood in general, not just with the medications, with Jeannie Stolzer, my friend and professor out in Nebraska. And I'm going to let Jeannie know how much her taking a stand on this issue has been appreciated. And thank you for the people who wrote in about it. Yes, I did read your messages. So thank you very, very much. And don't forget the way you can get in touch with me so that I'll read your messages is on breganlive@hotmail.com. breganlive@hotmail.com. And I think that about covers most of my introductory material. I'm glad to be on the air with you, although I am still working my way out of the virus, which now requires some antibiotics to handle the finishing up end of it. I think it's gone from virus to something else that the doctors cannot detect, despite swabbing my nose. But I'm getting better. That is absolutely for sure. Now, I want to introduce to you again Gail Tash. Dale wrote to me briefly. I'm a board-certified psychiatrist, attended Loyola University and Stitch School of Medicine, finished a residency at the Mayo Clinic. You can't get much more establishment than that. Maybe you can't get any more establishment than that in Rochester, Minnesota. And she does a lot of inpatient work, often, coming in and substituting for other psychiatrists who are away. She had 9 years that on an adolescent residential treatment unit, so she's very interested in that. She can talk to you about that. And she wrote to me, I believe that people can live strong, powerful lives with the correct approach using psychotherapy, nutrition, and meditation. Does that sound interesting? Sound familiar? I believe people should receive the best mental treatment for mental health problems. And with proper help, one can live their life with joy and abundance. And she's also doing an increasing amount of testifying, both to keep people out of the system and to help people get out of the system later on. And we'll talk about a whole bunch of different things. And Gail, thank you for getting in touch. I think, did it start with you getting in touch with Ginger, or did Ginger get in touch with you? How did you first make your contact that led to me?
Well, that's a very good question, and I really did want to connect with you, Peter, because I was actually testifying in a different state for a man who had committed a violent crime, and the reason he committed the violent crime was because he was started on a psychiatric medication regimen where he developed severe akathisia and psychosis, and he had been found not guilty by reason of insanity but was incarcerated for a very, very long time. He would like to get released from the forensic mental health unit where he is currently at, and so I did testify as a psychiatrist in support of his release. So as I was getting grilled by the state's attorney and the judge, I was thinking, oh boy, I have to talk with Dr. Peter Bregan because this is really tough stuff. It's quite an experience to testify in the courtroom and say, yes, these nice doctors who bring these drugs to the patients and such are giving people medication that causes them to be violent and have terrible side effects. So it's hard for the legal profession, even the medical profession, of course, to get their minds around that. So that is a new avenue of my practice now, is doing forensic work, which is very much like the work you've done chronicled in the book Medication Madness. So I decided I have got to connect with Dr. Peter Bruggen, and I did send you a letter, and you and Ginger warmly responded, and I'm so happy to talk with you and connect with you about our like thinking about mental health care and psychiatry.
And folks, this is Gail Tash's, like T as in cash, Tash's,
that's right,
first radio show. So welcome aboard. You have such a strong and direct way of communicating. It's going to be a pleasure to talk about all these different things. When was your first contact with me? I think you first read one of Bob Whitaker's books and then learned about me.
Right. So it certainly is a process, an evolution to be a psychiatrist these days, and realize that a lot of what happens in mental health care is actually quite harmful to patients. And the way it started is I was the medical director of an adolescent unit at our local hospital. I'm not a child psychiatrist, but they couldn't find anybody. They needed a psychiatrist to staff the unit until they found a child psychiatrist. So I said I'd do it for 6 months, but it took them 9 years to find a child psychiatrist. So I was doing inpatient child psychiatry work, and it's the only unit in all of Western Wisconsin. So I saw all these kids from all over. I saw all the different ways that child psychiatrists and family doctors were practicing, the kind of medications they were given. Almost all the children were given some type of medication by either a family practice doctor, pediatrician, or child psychiatrist. And what I saw were tremendous side effects of these from the medications that were given. And, of course, almost all the children did not have a mental illness, in my opinion. They had ADD, affection deficit disorder. That's a new term I recently used. And they really needed family help. The kids were not getting their needs met. Nobody was teaching them no means no. They weren't getting the affection and attention and discipline that they needed. Of course, they were having mental health symptoms. They would act out. They'd be depressed. They might have thoughts of self-harm or cutting. And they were invariably put on one or two or seven medicines, which many times made things worse. But what I saw was tremendous side effects with these kids. They would be so sedated, they could hardly lift their head off the table. I've seen tardive dyskinesia, weight gain, 50-100 pounds, akathisia. Probably about half of children and adolescents that are started on antidepressant medication will develop suicidal thoughts. It's so common. But many times the practitioners just think that, oh, they have suicidal thoughts because they have depression. They're already on an antidepressant. They must be depressed. So they need maybe a second antidepressant or a higher dose or a mood stabilizer or two mood stabilizers. But really, they just needed the original medication discontinued. I don't know if that's something you've observed, Peter.
All the time. Go ahead. But yes, I observe that all the time. Go ahead.
Yeah.
So let me ask you a question, actually, that was on my mind as long as we interrupted your flow. I don't get to talk a lot of times directly to my colleagues. You're among them more. Are they just in denial that they think the black box warnings don't matter for children on suicidal behavior?
It's so interesting you should ask, and I don't talk to a lot of colleagues too much either, but it's great always to talk with you. I went to one of the drug dinners. You know, I always tell people, leave your integrity at home. I go to a drug dinner because I just like to see what people are saying and thinking and what the lectures are like. So I went to a drug dinner. It was on Rexulti, a new It's an antipsychotic. And the first thing the lecturer said at the dinner, you know, it's fancy, best restaurant in town, great food, blah, blah, blah. So first thing this lecturer says is, because of the FDA, I have to show you this warning. This is the it was the first slide. And the warning was suicidality in adolescence, the usual black box warning. And he said, I just want to tell you that this really isn't true. This is probably some type of way that the kids were acting when they did the studies. And it's, you know, he totally downplayed the black box warning. And I raised my hand and I said to him, I see every day adolescents get suicidal from antidepressants. We shouldn't downplay this warning. So he did backpedal a little. But doctors are very brainwashed. The industry has totally taken over psychiatry. The industry is responsible for the education, the research, and the practice of psychiatry. And when one goes to a medical education conference, it's very industry pervasive. I mean, they're trying to get away from that. Now doctors have to disclose that they get money from the pharmaceutical industry. But I don't think that erases the conflict of interest. Now, I think they should disclose the amount because a lot of the speakers are getting millions, literally millions, from the pharmaceutical industry. And that really does enter into the debate here, that these doctors get so much money that they have total bias in their lectures. And doctors who attend the continuing medical education lectures don't realize that it's these doctors that give the lectures are just mouthpieces for the pharmaceutical industry. So it's not, even though they disclose that they get money, it'd be interesting to see how much money, and some of the continuing medical education that I do, which is Audio Digest, I get the CDs, some doctors work for 20 companies. They list, oh, I get money from 20 companies or 10 companies. And it'd be interesting to know how much money. It's in the millions. A lot of these big lecturers, the industry leaders, get literally millions from the pharmaceutical industry, and they of course aren't going to say the real story, the story that you and I see, the damage from the drugs that people experience, unfortunately.
When did you first start to become disillusioned? I mean, you had a very traditional training.
Correct. Correct.
When did it first start to cross your mind that maybe you weren't doing the right thing for your patients?
Well, first of all, I was always called a quote unquote light medicator, so I really was never a big drug person, you know. And I do psychotherapy. If I was doing a medication check, I knew what was going on in their life and their family and what their problems were. So in my residency, it was called an eclectic residency, not a biological residency. And I did learn therapy, and I always, even though I was, of course, for years a medication prescriber, I really did not prescribe huge doses or all the time.
Right.
Some people didn't get. So,
do you have any idea? I'll bet the Mayo is not eclectic anymore.
None of them are.
Yeah.
There's that book Unhinged by a Harvard psychiatrist. He said, I never learned psychotherapy. I learned psychotherapy, and even if I was doing medication management, even now, I want to know what the salient issues are in somebody's life, you know, because that's usually where they need the help, you know, of course. But so you asked me about when the light came on, and so I can tell you the exact moment, actually. I was making rounds on the adolescent unit when I was medical director, and I walked into this young kid's room. He was like 16 or 17. He was very, very overweight. Of course, the weight comes from the medication. And he said, you know, I have a personality disorder. And he was so ashamed of that. Like, this label was put on him. And he just seemed like a very nice young man. There's probably nothing wrong with him besides the usual adolescent issues. And, you know, I would see frequently with the adolescents a weight gain of 50 pounds or 100 pounds. The Zyprexa and Risperdal, they put weight on these kids like nothing. So here he had experienced severe side effects, and I stood there looking at this young kid, and I thought, you know, this is a crime. And I was thinking, I am a witness daily to a crime. These children who had mental health issues being put on usually five medicines or two medicines or sometimes seven. And of course they don't work, and then there's side effects and they're given more medicine. So that was probably about 15 years ago, and I thought, this is horrific. This is a crime that we're doing to these children. Beautiful girls diagnosed with bipolar disorder, put on atypical antipsychotics and gaining weight, and their health is ruined because, you know, people, it's too hard to lose it. They have metabolic syndrome, and, you know, their whole life they're going to be obese and develop diabetes, and people even die from these medicines. And even in mainstream psychiatry, we're told as psychiatrists that anybody that takes an atypical antipsychotic will lose 15 to 25 years off their life. Now, that's not the anti-psychiatry. That's the mainstream psychiatry will say that the atypical antipsychotics, one develops metabolic syndrome, diabetes, and chronic disease. They don't live a normal lifespan. Now, there's a lot of backpedaling on that, but I've heard that from more than one, you know, industry source, honestly. And that's horrific, and I tell people that, and they're shocked, because we should tell people what I learned in my continuing medical education: this drug will take 15 to 25 years off your life. That should be part of the conversation if a doctor prescribes that kind of medication, right? But nobody does. It's kind of a secret.
it's a terrible state of affairs, absolutely terrible. It's good to hear a colleague talk about it that directly and refreshingly.
Right.
Now, currently, I mean, if you had your choice, if you could work independently, because I know mostly you are... you're working with institutions. You do some telemedicine with some institutions.
I freelance. I like my life because I fill in at hospitals. I work weekends. I do some telehealth. I manage the medications at a residential treatment center for adolescents, and I usually end up just reducing the kids' meds. And my performance reports there say, we are very concerned about Dr. Tash's decrease of the medications, you know. So so I do different things, and I don't like to do outpatient medication management, which means outpatient psychiatry, whatever, because, first of all, I like to help people get off medication, but most people don't want to. I just want somebody to prescribe my meds. I just want the Adderall and the Xanax prescribed, and that is something I don't want to do. And then if I do a medication management visit, let's say in Wisconsin here, I get $23 for the medication management visit, and I can prescribe $5,000 worth of medication at that visit. It just doesn't seem right, you know. These newer drugs are all like $3,000 a month or $10,000 for 3 months. You know, the new Abilify injections are $2,500 a month, you know. So it's just not a good situation, in my opinion, to do outpatient unless somebody comes and says, I want off the medicine. But then again, that's can be a difficult, long trial to withdraw from medicine that somebody's been on for years.
You think it's easier? I think it would be much easier to withdraw people who are in the hospital. Is that part of what you're experiencing?
I do a lot of that, But if somebody has been on medicine for years and years and years, it's a catch-22, because the withdrawals can be very severe. And I'm sure you're familiar with that New York Times article that was published a couple months ago about how difficult it is for people to stop antidepressant medication when they've been on it for years and years and years. It's horrific.
Well, of course, I've been saying that for years and years and years and years. But the New York Times lately has not been speaking to me. I used to get all kinds of wonderful letters to the editor published in the New York Times. I mean, I'm a dozen or more years ago. And then all of a sudden, as often happens, something changed. And now people tell me that when they say to some of the New York Times reporters, thank you for calling me, but why don't you also call Dr. Bregan? And they may get a straightforward answer. I'm not talking to him. So I don't have a big positive audience at the New York Times. If you had your way, and were treating people in a hospital, new admissions, would you put any of them on medication? What would be your ideal way? I'm just trying to see where your thinking is overall
issues. I would not recommend starting an antidepressant. Almost everybody comes in on medicine. Very few people are not on any. Now, I told you I fill in. The hospital I filled in at last week, when I left there on Friday, I'm thinking, who's ever taken over for me is going to be really surprised because these people aren't on any medicine, because that's not ever happening. But I don't recommend
So you had admissions to the hospital over a few-day period, and you didn't put people on meds?
Yes. Oh, yes. If somebody's very psychotic, I might a low dose of antipsychotic, very low dose. But I work with a therapist, and we actually managed a young man, very psychotic, and he's on a tiny, tiny bit of antidepressant, which I think he can withdraw from. But I want to do more of that, take somebody with a newly psychotic diagnosis and work with that person with the therapist I work with and try to manage their psychosis without medication.
Yeah, and I would suggest if you feel like the situation is so out of control that, you know, that you'll just get pressured if you don't put them on medicine, give them a nice sleeping medication. Stay away from the antipsychotics and let them get a good night's sleep from some mild sedative. And may find that this does a great deal for somebody overnight.
You know, it's interesting you should say that because there was a reference in Robert Whitaker's book where there was a good study that he cites where benzodiazepines were used for psychosis very short term, and they were very effective. And
I think one reason they're very effective is because they're so much less damaging in the short run than the antipsychotics, which make it impossible for you to relate to the person, period.
And the antipsychotics are very dangerous.
So badly.
Yeah. And see, what I see now, and I'm learning all on my own, and I'm glad I can be associated with you, Peter, is when I see people that have been on antipsychotics for like 30 years, it's so sad because their brain has changed so much from being on that medicine. And if they, quote, go off their meds, they invariably have all kinds of symptoms, which are withdrawal, you know. It's really a tough situation. And what I've done is make tiny, tiny reductions over a long period of time, and one can have some good success that way.
Yeah, it's very, very hard when people have been on all those years. And by the way, I'm not recommending benzos as a first line of helping anybody. And in my practice,
and I wouldn't either. But I think you're right. Sometimes psychosis is stress and lack of sleep in the extreme.
Yes.
because we know that lack of sleep causes psychosis.
Any serious stress can push some people over. No, there's no doubt about it.
Right.
You know, becoming psychotic is not like becoming a different kind of human being. It's just your life is turning into a nightmare, quite literally. I mean, that's the simplest, I think, and best formulation for psychosis, is your life starts to turn into a nightmare and you can't tell the difference at times between the nightmare and the non-nightmare.
In one of your books, you say that the voices is the thoughts that you can't handle, that you're projecting outward, that's in your
Often it is. Yeah. And it often has a nightmarish quality of just being, you know, threatened, more mildly nagged, but outright threatened. It's a state of just utter vulnerability.
And it certainly could be a temporary situation.
Oh,
and
absolutely.
I tell people all the time, I say, other doctors are going to tell you that you need to be on medicine for the rest of your life, but I don't agree with that. And I tell them, do your own research. And I'm just saying my opinion, because my opinion is so different than everybody else's. But one of the things, I'll tell you the thing I see the very most, where all the hospitals I go to, I see something again and again, and I'll have three people like this. I see young people in their 20s that smoke marijuana regularly, and they're psychotic. I see that so much. Marijuana causes psychosis, and I tell people, if you don't use, you're not going to get psychotic again, because I think it's a substance-induced psychosis. But that's, honestly, that's what I see so much right now. And, you know, sometimes methamphetamine-induced psychosis also, but the marijuana
I'm so glad you're talking about that. One of the saddest of my incomplete therapy experiences was trying to take a young man off multiple drugs that he was on while living at home. And we'd make some progress. And in addition to then the conflicts at home that we had to try to handle, he would smoke dope. And he'd relapse. He'd come back in. I'd say, "Were you smoking again?" "Well, yeah." There's just no doubt about it that this is just not... Not really good for folks in terms of being alert and having your full faculties, and it does pitch some people into psychosis. I've certainly seen it in my practice too, and the scientific literature is on it. And I'm glad you brought it up, because I'm sure a lot of my audience, people smoke marijuana, and they're more and more, or they, you know, now they imbibe it by various ways. And it's going to be happening more and more. And the doses that the people are getting from commercial marijuana now can be far in excess of what they can get by the old methods. And so they're going to be more and more psychoses. And also just over the years, you know, we used to call the people who smoked dope for years used to call themselves deadheads. They used to comment on their... you know, loving their lack of initiative and their lack of concern. And this is what happens. Go ahead.
Yeah. THC content is high, much higher. I mean, when I was in high school, the THC content was like 3 to 4%, and now it's in the teens, like 13-14%. So it's different than, it's much more concentrated now, what they're growing. So...
commercially, where you could take it, you know, you can take your pills as much more freely than trying to smoke stuff, and it's just very easy now to get way up in the doses.
What happens though with these young men, and there's many of them that get psychotic from marijuana. 9 times out of 10, they're going to be told they have schizophrenia or bipolar disorder, which they don't have. They have a substance-induced psychosis, and then they get on the shots, the injectable, the monthly long-acting injectables, and then they're their lives are over because they'll be under a commitment and they lose their lives because they get into the mental health system and it's hard to get out.
With the people that you see, do you get to see some of them long enough, a week or two, or whatever, to actually help them recover from the acute psychosis without medication or with very little?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I think, to tell you the truth, I think smaller doses are more effective, you know.
Well, I think because there's just less, and if you got down to zero, you'd be even more effective. But certainly, small doses of any sedative-like drug can give people a break
in
the stress,
I
guess.
So I'm learning a lot here. That's very true. And sometimes it's these people that come in who are psychotic, they're away from their stress, they're going to get better on their own. And also, psychosis generally is self-limited. So a lot of people, they think, oh, the nurse, they're responding to their meds. The meds are finally working. Well, the psychosis is self-limited, and the person's away from the stress, and they're going to get better anyway. Just like depression gets better on its own also, actually. Right?
Yeah. This is incredibly important to hear this from you. You're really on the front lines, and you may be one of the few people in the world with this information, because there are very few people working right within the system who don't put everybody on drugs as soon as they...
Right, that's true, and so far I really haven't gotten a lot of pushback. Your old friend, Dr. Saz, he said he was an atheist teaching theology. You know, he was a psychiatry professor, and that's how I feel, actually, you know.
He was not a history professor. He wrote a lot about the history of psychiatry, but Tom was a good old psychiatrist who was trained as a psychoanalyst, interestingly enough.
Didn't he work at a university?
He was in the medical center at the State University of New York.
So he was
in a medical center, and that's why I got to know him, because I took my internship when I found out where he was. He had just published The Myth of Mental Illness in 1962, and I got in touch with them right away, and they said they were filled for their internships. They only had two people, but I came up and visited, and they dropped one of those two people, and that's how I ended up being with Tom Zoss for a couple of years. But
that must have been a great experience.
It was in many ways, but Tom was not an empathic human being. Tom's great contribution was his libertarianism, applying the principles of liberty to psychiatry and applying reason to issues like mental illness, and to see that it was a myth, a creation that had nothing to do with the realities of real medicine, where you have actual physical disorders. I mean, he just cut through that very beautifully. He didn't deny that people suffered or that people hallucinated. He rejected the idea that these were medical illnesses. They hadn't proven to be so, and they looked like something very different than that when you talk to the people. But Tom was not a very caring person, to say the least. And that in a way liberated him to just say things like, which I would never want to do, which is, if a person's on death row, he should have by his side an option of killing himself every day so that he could do it if he wanted to. And I just didn't go and see things like that. But I don't want to get into a lot of that. But I learned to think much more completely rationally about psychiatry. I already had a lot of my views when I met him. That's why I went there. But he was so incisive, and particularly about involuntary treatment, and particularly about the mythology of the so-called diseases, which they aren't. But from a viewpoint of being a therapist, helping people, wanting to be genuine and open and caring with your patients, I think he would have viewed that as psychoanalytically as transference.
Well, or countertransference.
Yes, countertransference. That's what you would have viewed it as.
Which is not a bad thing.
Well, good for you. Did you have some psychoanalytic experience or training at the Mayo?
Well, actually, we had one of the professors at Mayo was an analyst, and he gave lectures, and we would sit and talk, and we had Wednesday afternoons psychotherapy discussions and such. So we certainly were exposed to it, read about it, and learned all types of different psychotherapies, actually, you know. And I think mostly people at the time of my training at Mayo did like an insight-oriented type of psychotherapy, which I think was pretty useful to help people. But I never did any type of psychoanalysis myself. Peter?
I had therapy. Excuse me, I put on my mute to suppress a cough so all of you wouldn't have to suffer with it. And then I'm so interested in what you're saying that I forgot to turn my my mute off. With you here, I wanna go back to this. What a rich source you are on your experiences on the wards, treating people without medications. Do you ever work with the whole family, or do you focus on individuals? I do a lot of family work, especially if a psychotic young person. I'll insist on working with the family as well.
I almost always talk with the family, especially with the adolescents. But to tell you the truth, almost all the admissions, people are on meds, and they are admitted because of problems with the medications they are on. So
you said something to me that was very interesting when we were talking before, a day or two ago, and that is that I think you said at least 2/3 of the admissions were there really for drug reactions. But
right.
I imagine the psychiatrists don't see it at all, the other psychiatrists.
No. Like, okay, the hospital I'm sitting at now, a lady, I'm taking over. I started on Monday at this hospital filling in. Lady screaming, crying, taking her clothes off in front of everybody, delusional, out of her mind. And so the director said, well, we got to get her in a commitment situation and send her to a state hospital. And then I thought, oh, I read something in her paperwork. I went back and I was reading all the history, and she had had a psychiatry appointment the Friday before her admission. And she was living at home, you know, somebody with mental health issues. She was living alone, independently, went and saw this psychiatrist. He added 10 milligrams of Zyprexa on top of the unbelievable amount of risperidone, and that changed her behavior suddenly. She was taken to the ER, and now she's hospitalized at the hospital I'm at. So I said to the director, I said, something happened when she saw the psychiatrist the Friday before she was admitted. And so the director looked it up. She said, 10 milligrams of Zyprexa was added. So I stopped the Zyprexa, and the report this morning, the nurse said, oh, she's cooperative. She was playing cards. It's like a switch went on. You know, the light switch went on. She's a totally different person now. And this is the type of good things that happen when one recognizes that these medicines are very damaging and very dangerous. And if you look at that approach, if you look at the medicine saying, what's the problem here? I can see it. I feel like it's so clear to me, but nobody else sees it. So here this lady was going to go down the route of, she has to be committed. She has to go to state hospital. And I said, gee, let's take away that Zyprexa, and now she's, I don't think she's at baseline yet, but it was, the nurse said, oh, she's totally different. She's not screaming, crying. She's not needing PRN medication. She's sleeping. And so that's the kind of experience I'm having, which is very positive and enjoyable. But it doesn't, it's not always that easy. But I'm finding that a lot of people are admitted because of negative side effects from the many, many medications they're on.
What do you think it is? You know, I think it's a combination of the training and then you're stuck in these facilities. You don't have alternatives. Like in this particular case, you don't have alternatives.
This is all a big business.
Tough situation for the people in it. Yeah.
But all of healthcare is just a business. It's just a machine. It makes money. We're all trends in this big machine. And it's people get sucked into the system, and it's very hard to get out of the system. And I'm doing my own thing, working against the system, and some of the people I see have really benefited, not everybody, but it's an interesting, as I said, the atheist teaching theology thing that's going on, you know, where I'm a psychiatrist, but not agreeing with the current paradigm.
Are we covering everything that you want to cover for this, your first ever radio show? How do you feel you're doing on your first ever radio show?
Well, I hope
I think you're doing
okay.
Great.
I'm so happy to be communicating with you because I'm doing the forensic work that I mentioned and working with, I want to mention, Marcy Weber, who is in a forensic mental health unit in Illinois, who, secondary to severe side effects of psychiatric medications, in a very delusional, bizarre state, unfortunately murdered her three-year-old daughter, and she is now incarcerated in a mental health unit because she was found not guilty by reason of insanity, and I'm helping her be released, and there's a hearing next week in Illinois that I'll be testifying at, and I get a lot of inspiration
years. Let
from
people
you,
know.
Peter.
I think you said 16 years she's been incarcerated.
About that, yes.
Which is more than she would have gotten in possibly if she pleaded guilty, flat out guilty.
Right.
Instead.
Right. It's so hard for those people to get out of facilities, and they treat her so horribly that she has like constant body searches, frequent room checks. She can't have papers in her room to prepare for court, and it's pretty onerous.
Yeah, that is very, very difficult. And she's given you permission to talk about her on the air. I want to confirm that for the audience. I wanted to be very clear about that.
And I even got permission from her attorney, Peter.
Good.
He said, go for it. So.
All right. I'm very glad, and I really recommended that, and I'm so glad to have you talk about it. And what we'll do on a future show, very likely, if it's possible, is have her on the air along with Dr. Tash, Gail Tash, who was my guest, and maybe her lawyer, and talk about these issues. And you feel it's safe for her to be released now?
Oh, yes. She had one psychotic episode, and that was because she was on high doses of two antidepressants, which is very substandard care, and she had to stop those meds because she was traveling and she didn't get them refilled, and she had an abrupt cessation of those she stopped those medications abruptly because she didn't have refills, and then Ambien was added. She went to somebody and got Seroquel first and then Ambien for sleep, and so she was in severe withdrawal from the psychiatric medications and was highly delusional, believing somebody was going to do something terrible to her daughter, and she thought in her delusional state that it would be better for her to kill her daughter rather than her daughter suffer the fate that her delusions thought was going to happen. And Marcy has not, she had not been psychotic prior to that episode related to the psych drugs, and she has not been psychotic since that episode.
You know, there's a, probably a strong possibility that the withdrawal was also worsened by the Ambien. Ambien can make people do things in a completely unconscious state.
Right.
They're literally sleepwalking and doing dangerous and destructive things.
Right. And there have been other people that have murdered while being on Ambien. So there are some articles about that out there, too.
Well, good. You're going to do a good job on this. Gail, let me introduce you to one of my callers who is practically a member of the show, Sarah in California, and who's actually been on the air with me as a guest because she's such a good caller and such a good person. Sarah, hi.
Hey, Dr. Bregan. Hi, Dr. Cash. How are you both doing?
Hi, Sarah. Doing great.
Oh, I'm so glad. I'm calling because I'm curious why it isn't like practice for psychiatry to test for metabolic byproducts of the medications that's prescribed when people have these rapid changes in behavior. I would think that would be like the initial, oh, we got to check for metabolic byproducts.
Well, I don't know what one would look for. I mean, if you know, one always gets a medication history to know what they were taking. You know, usually you find out, you know, there was where some medicine started, where some stopped, and as Peter points out, any med change up or down, starting or stopping medication. So, but we generally don't look at the byproducts or metabolic endpoints. I don't know how that would help, honestly.
Sarah, the only place I've seen that be somewhat relevant is to look at the active breakdown products that might last longer in the blood in a criminal case. For example, the shooter in Arizona, that one of our worst shootings we've ever had from that hotel. It turned out that he was on Valium, and you could tell from the breakdown products that he had this in his system a while. So it can be useful at times to to check on the blood and not just the actual original drug, but any metabolic breakdown products that might be active.
Sarah, unless you're thinking of something else,
the real issue is they're not checking blood levels at all. I mean, that's the real issue.
Mm-hmm. I'm thinking of this because I was in acutely psychotic, agitated, catatonic state. It was active psychosis with catatonia until I could actually communicate, and then it was nothing but like agitation, like agitated psychomotor skills and all of that. And my blood work came back normal, and they decided to do ECT. And it wasn't until they discovered that I actually had, even though I had a normal liver function panel, and I had normal levels of the Depakote in my system, I actually had toxic levels of ammonia in my system. And I've been on Depakote for 6 years or something like that. And so gradually my body had lost the ability to process the ammonia. And there's actually two published cases of people having this catatonic state because of elevated ammonia in the bloodstream. And I know that that is a frequent byproduct of the medications that people get on. And they're just never looking for it.
Well, Depakote is known to alter the metabolic pathways in the liver. It changes even how other drugs are metabolized. That's pretty well known, but I don't think we've ever looked at, as psychiatrists, we don't look at ammonia levels generally,
Yes, Sarah, send me some literature on this. This is not familiar to me, so I can't say any more than that at this point.
Yeah.
So send me some of the literature you may have on ammonia levels, and I'll be glad to have a look at it, okay?
Sounds great. Thank you so much.
Hey, thank you for calling in. We're getting near the end of our show with Gail Tash. Gail, you're in Wisconsin. You don't have a private practice. Would you like to leave contact information for anybody who might just want to chat with you? You're not treating private patients, right?
Right. I can give my email out.
But only if you want to. It's not something you need to do. I should have talked to you about this to begin with.
Okay, so I don't care.
People
could
write
to
me if they want to talk to you. Why don't we do that, since you weren't prepared? Folks, write to me at BreganLive@Hotmail.com. Write to me at BreganLive@Hotmail.com, which is our show's dedicated to the show email. And if you want to get in touch with Gail, I will forward the email to her.
That sounds perfect.
Yeah, that'd be good. I don't want to put you in an awkward position. Any closing thoughts?
Well, I am so delighted to have this opportunity to talk for an hour. I like to talk, so that's not a problem. And I'm very happy that you recognize my journey and how important it is, the work we do. And it does slay me that doctors like me who go through residency and practice and such, we have a health system that is not set up to be in the best interest of our patients. And it's not just psychiatry, it's other specialties also. But I just feel blessed that I understand that and can see through the veneer of our corporate healthcare system.
Yes, it's happening throughout the country in all areas of medicine. Gail Tash, thank you a million for being on the show and for debuting your views this way on the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour. Thanks so much, Gail. Bye-bye.
You're very welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye, my wonderful audience. Bye-bye.